The Guardian.
Greater Manchester is forced into a Tier 3 lockdown as the government suffers a defeat over the Internal Market Bill. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
I mean, it's brutal, to be honest, isn't it? This is no way to run the country in a national crisis. It isn't. This is not right.
After a standoff that lasted more than a week between Westminster and local officials, Boris Johnson announced at a press conference on Tuesday that he was unable to secure a deal with the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham. Labour's Burnham couldn't help but show his anger as he was shown the terms under which his region would go into Tier 3. So will Boris Johnson be picking a fight with every region he attempts to place into Tier 3? How will local officials respond to such heavy-handed tactics? Elsewhere, the Welsh First Minister Mark Drakeford announced that Wales would enter a national two-week firebreak lockdown, and the Republic of Ireland will also enter its highest level of COVID restrictions for 6 weeks from today. Will Boris Johnson be able to hold out against a similar approach for England? Meanwhile, peers in the House of Lords were busy voting against the government on the controversial Internal Market Bill ministers claim is essential to getting Brexit done. And while Downing Street hasn't quite slammed the door on Brexit talks with Michel Barnier, they have said it's only ajar. So what happens next? And in the second of our mini-series on parliamentary select committees, my colleague Rajiv Sayal speaks to Caroline Noakes, the Tory MP who chairs the Women and Equalities Committee. Plus, I chat to the comedian and former Labour Party member Matt Ford about his new book, Politically Homeless. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, as the Prime Minister attempts to put fires out all over the place, I thought it best to catch up with my colleague, The Guardian's political correspondent, Peter Walker. Peter, thanks for chatting. The mood yesterday evening in Manchester was confused and angry. It was pretty confusing in Westminster yesterday too. You're there today. What's the mood like today?
I mean, it's kind of a little bit the morning after the night before, in that yesterday was so chaotic that people are surely thinking you can't have another day like that. And that hopefully might have been peak chaos. But I mean, certainly amongst Tory MPs, there's this quite big dissatisfaction with the way not only the actual implementation on rules in Greater Manchester has taken place, but also the kind of wider perception of the way it's been done, and the kind of PR optics yesterday were completely dreadful.
So it was a £5 million gap between the two sides in the end, wasn't it? How on earth did we get there?
I mean, it's quite weird given the sense of, you know, you have a test and trace system, which is costing whatever, £12 billion, then £5 million is in Treasury terms the kind of loose change you find down the back of the armchair, or kind of rounding up error. And it kind of seems to come down to a point of principle that Andy Burnham, the Greater Manchester Mayor, was insistent that 65 million was the absolute minimum amount he could agree to get the city to go into Tier 3. And the Treasury balked and said 60 million was as far as it went. And yes, it does seem like a kind of tiny amount, but both sides were very, very kind of rigidly sticking to what they said.
And then we had this very odd situation, didn't we, where Burnham had given this very dramatic press conference saying, you know, Boris Johnson was playing poker with people's lives. And then Prime Minister didn't seem to be able to answer the question of whether that £60 million offer that he'd made was still on the table or not, did he? It was very odd.
We had this very, very strange kind of PR situation for a matter of like a couple of hours where the talks had collapsed. And basically there were briefings going on that because Greater Manchester had turned down the £60 million, you know, which is to support businesses and low-paid people, they would now kind of be punished and get less, which seemed a bit crazy. But then at the end of Andy Burnham and the other Manchester mayor's press conference, they were kind of watching live reports coming in from Manchester MPs who were being briefed. And this figure of £22 million came in. So everybody suddenly thought, oh my goodness, they're being punished. Rather than getting 60 million, they're only getting 22 million. As it turns out, that is extra support, which is what every city which goes into Tier 3 gets for local tests and trace. And at his press conference, when Boris Johnson was asked about this, he should have seemingly said, oh, no, that's something completely different. The 60 million is still there. But either he didn't want to say it, or he wasn't quite clear, or he didn't know. But it took until the Commons statement at 7 p.m. before people actually knew that. And by which point, this idea of they've only got 22 million was all over the internet, even though it wasn't actually true.
Yeah, and I got several hurried calls, I have to say, last night from Downing Street insiders, shall we say, trying to effectively sort of correct the record or correct the impression that the Prime Minister had left at his own press conference, which was a pretty odd pretty odd situation. There's a sort of broader issue here, isn't there, which is about the underlying lack of generosity of the schemes that are available. So Boris Johnson kept saying, well, it's all right because we've got this job support scheme that the Treasury has set up. But part of the problem that Andy Burnham has repeatedly pointed to is that that scheme is a lot less generous than the furlough that we had earlier in the year that protected more of people's wages, isn't it?
Well, this has been Andy Burnham's point. You know, he keeps on referring back to, you know, the government's earlier line during the pandemic of we'll do whatever it takes to make sure nobody suffers because they're forced into lockdown or the company they work for closes. But the furlough scheme, as it was, paid 80% of wages. And this current job support scheme pays 67%. And ministers point out again and again that people can also get a universal credit top up, which means they might get more than 80%. But this is very, very complicated. Depends how many children you've got, depends all sorts of other factors. Obviously, as we know, universal credit is not the easiest thing in the world to claim. And the kind of view of the Metro mayors, and particularly Andy Burnham, is that if you are forcing a region to shut businesses and freelancers and people like door staff and bar staff and taxi drivers lose their incomes, then they need basically a guarantee.
Yeah, exactly. Peter, we saw that South Yorkshire this morning has agreed to go under tier three restrictions. They're the next sort of domino to fall, as it were. Do you think others also will now strike an agreement? Because it's not clear that Andy Burnham has got very much more out of his heroic stand, is it?
If anything good for number 10 has come from the last kind of 10 days of chaos, it could put some of the other metro mayors or other regions off from picking a fight like this. Because I think the kind of line in the sand that Downing Street wanted to make sure everybody knew was that the same basic deal would be on offer for every single region. But the counter argument to that is that if they wanted people to know that, they could have not just had these endless secretive talks, but maybe gone to Parliament and said, OK, if a region goes into tier three, they will get X million pounds, you know, as a proportion of what their population is, and just made it obvious. And that point has taken a long time to be made.
That certainly would have been a lot simpler for all of us. We also saw this week, Peter, the Welsh First Minister took the plunge on something Johnson seems dead set against, a temporary national circuit breaker. The rules in Wales are very tough, aren't they?
They really, really are tough. I mean, in many ways, it's like going back to the original March lockdown, except that schools and universities are going to be open. And this is really, really interesting in the sense that, you know, in the same way that mayors like Andy Burnham are getting a lot more kind of national prominence in being able to fight their corner, the devolved nations too. I mean, the longer the pandemic goes on, the more differences there are. And in terms of, you know, the United Kingdom, it's quite strange because people in Wales and Northern Ireland and Scotland are getting more and more used to kind of living under different rules.
And we've also got, in a way, a controlled experiment now, haven't we, to show how well this idea of a sort of circuit breaker works. Boris Johnson's determined to hold out against it, but we'll be able to see in Wales whether it has the big impact they hope, won't we?
Well, we kind of will. I mean, the one difference is, though, Wales obviously is a separate country, but in most of its legal terms, and certainly in border terms, it's part of a broader entity. So a lot of people travel in and out of Wales for work and seeing family and even schools and things like that. So, you know, you can't set up a border within a couple of days. So it's going to be strange. I mean, the rules are so tough that if it doesn't do anything, then that will allow Boris Johnson to say, well, circuit breakers don't seem to work.
Or if it doesn't do any more than the tier three restrictions in the hardest hit regions. Now, the talks between Manchester and Westminster weren't the only ill-tempered standoff this week. The Brexit talks are still just about alive, aren't they?
Well, they are. The door is ajar, to use Michael Gove's phrase, which he used several times over the weekend. And the whole thing is slightly strange because there seems to be this slightly kind of choreographed strop, you could almost call it, that Johnson and his ministers are doing, where they're insisting that the EU hasn't treated them seriously, it needs to fundamentally change its approach, etc., etc. And, you know, the kind of words they're saying are really tough. And if you didn't know anything about it, you think, oh my goodness, this is the end. But over in Brussels, people are looking at it with a slightly weary kind of scepticism, that a lot of the EU people seem to think that this is Johnson kind of making a stand for public consumption, after which he might then, you know, fold on a major concession, but claim it as this big win. But no one really knows yet.
And Theresa May said she wasn't terribly impressed this week, didn't she, with Michael Gove?
Well, Theresa May is not quite turning into kind of 90s-era Jeremy Corbyn, but she's, if not a serial rebel, then a serial malcontent.
The government appears resigned to the prospect of no deal. Yet one area in which they should not be resigned to the prospect of no deal is insecurity.
her focus with a no-deal Brexit has always been on security and policing and things like that. And during Brexit questions, she asked a very, very tough question about, you know, what, you know, you get in terms of arrest warrants and cooperation with other European police forces. And she didn't seem particularly impressed with the answer.
The second thing I would say is that there are many, many areas in which we can cooperate more effectively to safeguard our borders outside the European Union than we ever could inside through a variety of
measures. No, it's only, as you say, the latest of a whole series of issues she's rebelled on, isn't she? It's quite interesting, isn't it, as you know, if you followed her as we did while she was trying to resist those furious rebels on the back benches when she was Prime Minister. She seems to become quite a sort of stickler for particular causes, doesn't she?
Well, it also kind of indicates that her kind of much-dated mantra of no deal is better than a bad deal, I don't think she genuinely believes that.
No, it was hard to believe she ever did, wasn't it, really? And I think it's also a bit here, isn't there, about what kind of Conservative Boris Johnson is. And she's a very traditional small C Shire Tory, isn't she? And he very much is not that. And so we've seen all these issues, including things like planning and so on, where she's just unable to support this government, which is really, you know, quite radical, isn't it? And not very small C conservative in some ways.
Well, it kind of shows this kind of real tension in the conservatism or whatever it is that Johnson's trying to push through. The other thing where May has expressed a lot of concern about is this provision in the internal market bill, whereby the UK would break international law by potentially unilaterally rewriting part of the EU exit deal. That's the kind of thing where Theresa May shows she's very, very much more in a kind of Margaret Thatcher, John Major kind of conservative school, where the rule of law is seen as this kind of sacrosanct thing. It's part of almost this kind of, you know, post-war ethos of we have to do things by the rules. And Boris Johnson is a very, very different beast.
Yeah, interesting. And talking of the internal markets bill, it's been up in the Lords, hasn't it, this week? And peers revolted, didn't they? They voted quite strongly, overwhelmingly, in fact, for an amendment to the government's bill, which says it undermines the rule of law, making the same point, really, that Theresa May was making. What does it actually mean, though? What practical difference does it make that's now been amended by the Lords?
It doesn't make any difference whatsoever. It's basically the Lords expressing what many peers have already said. But it is notable just the strength of feeling in the Lords, where people are obviously much less bound by party whips. There were virtually no crossbenchers, who are the peers who don't belong to any particular party, who voted with the government on this. And it shows, I guess in political terms, it shows that Boris Johnson is very, very much kind of annoying, not just this kind of hinterland of older politicians, but older Tories too. I mean, we also had David Gawk, who was a Tory MP, was a Justice Secretary until 2019. He actually wrote a Guardian article condemning not only the Internal Market Bill for its promise to break international law, but he said he's worried that Boris Johnson kind of doesn't believe in the rule of law. And this is quite a big thing. But, you know, that's what a lot of more traditional Tories, you know, fear about him.
Yeah, it's a kind of anti-establishment mood or approach, isn't it? Which is, you know, as you say, not tremendously conservative in some ways. And with all these fights already raging on various fronts, that the government's also been resisting this week calls to extend free school meals provision for the poorest families through the holidays. It did this during the lockdown. It did it through the summer holidays after a lot of pressure, including from the footballer Marcus Rashford. And Labour is calling a vote today, later on Wednesday. Again, Rashford is calling for provision to be extended over half term, over the Christmas holidays. So I had a word with Shadow Education Secretary Kate Green about why Labour is campaigning on this issue.
So if there was a reason to do it in the summer, and I'm very glad the government eventually saw sense and did make that U-turn, those reasons have increased, if anything, since then. And by this half term, the Christmas holidays, and into next year, we will have many, many more struggling and desperate families who will need this help from government.
Peter, do you think the government's going to have to give in on this?
I genuinely don't know, because when ministers speak about this, they're quite adamant that they see this again as this kind of point of principle, that they say that free school meals are basically, you know, a school thing, and it's never been the responsibility of the government to feed children, you know, when they're not at school, or at least under the terms of this. And they argue that lockdown was different, that most children were not at school, and thus, you know, lots of people were out of work. There's two problems, one of which is if you were to ask the average person, you know, is the coronavirus pandemic over? They'd obviously and very correctly say no. Things are different. The economic situation is not a kind of typical one. So there's a very, very strong economic reason to make an exception for it. But the other one is the PR one. I mean, they're basically fighting against Marcus Rashford, you know, amongst many other people. But Rashford has become a kind of, you know, symbol for it. And he's not only fighting this very, very, very clever campaign, but as a figure, he's this kind of, you know, secular saint who also happens to be a very, very good sports player. And his Twitter reach is completely amazing. So last night he, you know, scored the winning goal in a Champions League tie for Manchester United, like the 87th minute, was able to tweet about that, showing a picture of him scoring the goal. And then in reply to that tweet, he says, oh, by the way, maybe can you do something about free school meals? And this is an incredibly difficult PR operation to battle against.
Yeah, it seems like yet another fight the government is picking that may not turn out well. All right. Thanks ever so much. Peter Walker, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
After the break, Rajiv Sial speaks to Caroline Noakes and I chat to comedian Matt Ford. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, last week, The Guardian's Whitehall correspondent Rajiv Sial kicked off a Politics Weekly mini-series where he speaks to some of the chairs of UK Select Committees about their role and what their committee oversees. This week he spoke to Caroline Noakes, the Conservative MP for Romsey and Southampton North and chair of the Women and Equalities Committee. Listeners may remember she was the Immigration Minister under Theresa May, who claimed she was subsequently sacked via Twitter by Boris Johnson. A former chief executive of the National Pony Society, who voted against same-sex marriage in 2013, she may not fit the stereotype of a champion for minority rights. But she has used the committee to call for the government to stop the erosion of access to facilities for disabled people, express concern about a lack of kindness in the debate over trans rights, and warned the government that we may see a spike in the demand for women's refuges because of coronavirus.
Caroline, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here today.
It's very difficult to talk about politics today without first addressing coronavirus and its impact. What are your concerns about the impact of the virus on the issues of equality?
It's really hard to know where to start with that question. The Women in Equality Select Committee very quickly launched an inquiry into the impact of COVID on people with protected characteristics. And it became very obvious very quickly that one inquiry wasn't going to be enough, that the impacts were so different for different groups of people that we split it into three. So you have the impact on women, which arguably is a very economic impact. The impact on BAME communities has been horrific. And of course, when it comes to disabled people, the ability of local authorities to deliver the care that is needed within the timeframes that are necessary for people to go about living their lives as fully as they A, would wish, but B, are legally entitled to. It's been an enormous piece of work, and one, of course, that is very obviously ongoing.
Do you think the government has acted with enough speed to protect BAME health workers in the second phase of the virus?
No, I don't. I don't think they've acted anywhere near quickly enough. And we saw some health trusts react very fast to bring in measures to protect BAME workers that were within their own areas. But that has been far from across the board. And what we've seen is so many BAME people working in frontline roles, whether that be in healthcare, social care, whether it be in transport. And I think we needed to not just try and understand, but to act, to bring in measures that may have protected more people. And I think it was very disappointing that the government's PHE review at the outset didn't even include any recommendations. And I think that has been incredibly damaging for the government's relationships with BAME communities up and down the country.
We now have a three-tier system in England where no matter the tier, hospitality jobs and jobs for the likes of cleaners will no doubt be affected again. Does it worry you that the same people who were hit the first time around will most likely be hit again?
Well, I think absolutely we should all be concerned that it's people in low-paid jobs who are being most significantly impacted, those who are in insecure employment. And we know that in this country, people from BAME backgrounds will most likely be in insecure employment. They are most likely to be found working in customer-facing roles or in patient-facing roles. And when I say patient, I also mean within the care sector. And so it is absolutely crucially important that we look carefully at the areas of the country that have been most severely impacted and start coming up with some strategies that can make sure that protective measures are in place.
Turning to the Black Lives Matter movement, the government has made noises about legislating to stop the removal of statues, plaques and memorials by councils following calls for changes in the way that slave owners and former colonial leaders are represented. What do you think of this?
I think it's absolutely imperative that we better explain what is there. It's not acceptable to have statues or works of art that give no indication of what someone's history has been. I think there are some circumstances where it's right to remove statues, where it's right to change the names of buildings. And I always highlight that my daughter for the last 3 years has lived in Bristol. And she looked at me, she said, I had no idea who Edward Colston was, except that there was a Colston girls' school down the road from where I lived. She had no idea, hadn't thought to ask the question, no inquiry whatsoever. And I think where there are very prominent names like that, then the explanations need to be given to people.
And I understand that the committee is looking at the way Black history is taught in schools. A survey conducted by The Guardian in July found that just 11% of GCSE students are studying modules that referred to Black people's contribution to Britain. Is this enough? And should Black history be a compulsory part of the curriculum as it once was?
I absolutely think we have to include Black history in our national curriculum. We have to make sure that it is taught much better than it is at present. And I always tell people, I can remember literally days before schools went into lockdown, having a meeting with a parent at a school in my constituency and the head teacher, and talking about the way he, the parent, was incredibly disappointed that Black history was not taught in the school. And we had a really useful and constructive discussion. And my argument throughout, from being told, well, there isn't enough room in the history curriculum to include Black History Month, I just made the point, well, I don't think that Black History Month has to be about history, doesn't have to be embedded in the history curriculum, and it doesn't have to be about 1 month in the year. We should work out how we can embed Black history and Black culture across the curriculum 12 months of the year, which I think is really important. That it's great and right and important that we celebrate Black History Month, but it shouldn't be 1 month in isolation.
Given what we know about Boris Johnson, that he referred to Black Africans as pickaninnies with watermelon smiles and claimed that voting Tory will cause your wife to have bigger breasts and use the term tank top bum boys to describe Peter Mandelson's associates, do you think that he really believes in equality?
I think that's a really difficult question. I'm always very conscious, even before I was chair of the Women and Equalities Committee, as a Home Office minister talking about immigration every day, I used to think very carefully about what language I would use. I knew that people would be looking to read into every word I said. So I always tried to think incredibly carefully before I opened my mouth. I think sometimes in the past, the Prime Minister has been very careless in the language that he's used. And I certainly look at comments like the ones that you've highlighted, you know, the comparing women in burqas to having letterboxes for mouths. I think that was just deeply offensive. And I think it's absolutely incumbent upon him in his current role to do an awful lot better than he has in the past.
Should we hear a single clear apology from him, for example, his comments on burqas, which I think he has fudged in the past?
Any of the
would you like to
thousands of articles, what I will say is, and I've already said sorry for any offence that I've caused, and I say it again, But let
so
me...
I think as a politician, it's sometimes very hard to say sorry, and sometimes it is the most important word that you can use. I think when you have made an error of judgment, as he undoubtedly had in the language he was using, you should absolutely come out, say sorry for it, say sorry clearly. None of the sort of fudged, I'm sorry if people feel, but I am sorry. And I know that politicians find that an extremely difficult word to use. But as I said, I think it's crucially important.
Boris Johnson floundered under your question in May when you asked him how many women in top government jobs would be enough to secure proper gender representation. Should the government set a target by a given date? And what should that target be?
Well, to my mind, that target has to be 50%. And I don't see the government is going to set itself a target, but I think it should be aiming towards achieving exactly that 50-50. And I won't rest until they are there. But I think we have a structural problem in Parliament where we still have far too few female MPs. And it's a great deal better than it was even 10 years ago when I arrived. But there is still a massively long way to go. And I looked, I have to say, with some envy across at the Labour benches after the last general election, where the vast majority of the new MPs were women. And they've done a great job in increasing the numbers of female parliamentarians in the Labour parliamentary party. And I think the Conservatives are still playing catch up. And we've got a long way to go. We're just a quarter of all Conservative MPs are female. So clearly we have to increase that number before we can hope to see much bigger numbers in government. But I think in the cabinet itself, the numbers are woefully low. And I think it's crucially important that they are added to at the next reshuffle. And I would love to see a minister in their own right attending cabinet as Minister for Women and Equalities, not just as an add-on to another existing cabinet role.
Just turning to another hot topic that comes under your committee, the government announced that it was abandoning plans to allow people to officially change gender without a medical diagnosis. But ministers have pledged to make the process cheaper and more straightforward. Trans rights activists were expectedly disappointed. Do you agree with this decision to backtrack on Theresa May's proposal?
So from a personal perspective, no, I don't agree with it at all. I know that my committee is considering the proposals that are coming out very closely. And what we've not seen yet are the final details. So I have no doubt that in the fullness of time, the committee will be launching an inquiry into the whole issue about trans rights. I think specifically the government's proposals will form part of that. But there are much wider issues, whether it's to do with healthcare, the way young trans people receive the level of education, the level of support whilst they're at school that they need. There is a wide range of issues that I have absolutely no doubt the committee will be looking at.
Many people have framed some of the intense rows that have gone on between trans activists and feminists as a clash between women's rights and trans rights. Is that how you see it?
It doesn't need to be. And I think that's the important thing, is that it has very much become a polarised debate where it's almost as if the person who shouts loudest wins. Actually, in many instances, when everybody is shouting, we all lose. So I think it's absolutely imperative that we improve the rights that transgender people have, that we try and take some heat out of the argument, because improving the rights of a transgender person does not diminish the rights of a woman in any way at all. In fact, we would all benefit. And I think I'm on record as saying that we need to have a great deal more kindness in this debate. We also need to be much more measured in it. There is a real tendency, I find, it's only the very extremes of the argument that ever get heard. And in the middle of the debate, there are some very rational, considered people who just want to see the rights of individuals, I was about to say upheld, not just upheld, improved. And I've certainly spent some time over the last 6 months since I became chair of the committee talking to people on both sides of the debate and listening. And I think that's the most important thing I can do at the moment, is learn more and come to understand more. And that's certainly what I'm focused on at the moment. But I think the committee will certainly be doing some work in this area very shortly.
Caroline Noakes, thanks so much for joining me on Politics Weekly.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
If you're interested in hearing more about the backstory to changes in the Gender Recognition Act, which Rajiv discussed with Caroline, check out the brilliant two-parter our sister podcast Today in Focus did recently on it. We'll include a link on the episode page. Now, for me, it was probably the miners' strike and the Falklands War that first got me gripped by politics. For comedian Matt Ford, it was Margaret Thatcher. His love of politics started young, but it didn't survive as long as he may have wished. At the start of October, he published a book titled Politically Homeless, detailing in many a funny and cringeworthy anecdote his life as a Labour member and the reasons he eventually chose to leave the party. A self-professed Blairite, yes they do still exist, he had a lot to say about the last decade in the Labour Party. We also discussed how, despite choosing a career as a political satirist, often voicing the character of Boris Johnson, he finds the current Prime Minister anything but a laughing matter. We recorded this interview in a week where my microphone didn't really behave, so I might sound a bit different. Apologies for that.
Hi, Matt. We've had to reschedule this interview a bit, didn't we? Because you've got quite a cool gig at the moment.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I'm one of the writers and one of the voices for Spitting Image, which it's just such a weird thing. It's only now that the show is actually on that it kind of feels real. I've been working on it for quite a few months now and voicing bits and writing bits. And then it's only when you actually see the whole thing come together, you realise you're part of something so special.
Now, we're recording this remotely, of course, as we've all been doing for months. But if we were in the studio, I dread to think what would have happened if we'd handed you a bottle of Evian. That was one of my favourite stories from the book. It probably would have given you PTSD, I think.
Oh, man. It's just so... I mean, the book is a story, really, of, you know, my brief political career really was defined by failure. I made so many mistakes. And I share some of those glorious defeats in the book, as well as a kind of comedic analysis of how we got where we are in British politics. But yeah, I mean, it was on a by-election in Northampton. You know, it's the least glamorous kind of story. It was a council by-election. We had a ministerial visit, and it was the week that Tony Blair had cleaned some graffiti up with a high-pressure nozzle. So that week, any visit we had, anything the Labour Party was doing was all about graffiti removal. And we're in this just tiny little square in Northampton. And I'd scoped it out the week before and thought, perfect. And then it was only when I was on the way there with a mop and bucket and a bit of Ajax, I thought, I haven't got any water. Like, what? They don't just have taps in the street. So then I quickly thought, right, I pulled in at the nearest shop. It was a Waitrose. It was the first time I'd ever been to one. And even then I was thinking politically, I was like, right, what's the cheapest one? You know, because, you know, receipts and things. So I Evian was on offer. And then we get to the thing. I was like, right, I need to go around the corner because I don't want to see the press. Anyway, I fill up this mop and bucket with Evian. So then we've got a minister trying to clean up graffiti with French mineral water. And obviously it doesn't work, right? And then the following day, the paper had got a picture of me. And the headline was, oh, yes, he did, with O spelt as the French for water. And a picture of me in a trench coat pouring Evian into this rusty mop and bucket. And it was like the most New Labour thing, like, young New Labour staffer tries to clean it up with Evian. Yeah, it was just a disaster.
Yeah, and glorious triumphs like that come in the career of somebody who started becoming obsessed with politics pretty young, didn't you? You won't be surprised to hear I completely identify with all of this bit, but you were nine, were you, when you first became politically aware?
Yeah, kind of 7, 8, 9. I just remember, or maybe it's the same for you, is that Thatcher was such a big deal in the house that I grew up in. Not in the sense that we were talking about politics, but just neighbours would talk about it. And if you're a kid, you're kind of hearing this name. And it was almost like she kind of ran the local area. I didn't know what a prime minister was or anything, but I remember the day she left vividly, just because everyone was talking about it on our street. And, you know, I grew up in inner city Nottingham in single parent household on benefits. We were really at the thin end of the wedge of the Thatcher years, not just in terms of their economic policy, but in terms of the moral judgment on mums like mine, which I always thought was, from a very young age, thought was really wrong. So her going kind of felt like, wow, our lives are going to improve now. You know, it was weird. And then just the years in between that, from 1990 to 1997, I go from being 7 to being 14. And Tony Blair's on the brink of victory. And, you know, at 14 in a country like ours, having lived through that period, I think a lot of people were really excited by it of all ages. So it was a really interesting time to grow up. And that's the only way I can explain it, is that I kind of, on some level, and I don't know how or why, I kind of clocked onto the fact early that politics was important.
When you get to 14 then, and you've seen the sort of interceding years, you quite fancy joining the Labour Party.
Oh, I couldn't wait to join. I was just desperate. The moment I was into it, I just thought, this is going to be great. You know, and I wrote to Blair to try and join, and you had to be 15 to join. And I was livid. I was like, why are you trying to put me off? So I joined the SWP, the Socialist Worker Party, and that lasted about a fortnight. And that was kind of like, that was exciting. And they treated me like an adult. You know, I've fond memories in some ways, but they were just so aggressive all the time that I just thought, oh, it was something about them that was quite scary in the end. So that didn't last long, my radical phase.
So how do you go from being a fan to working for Labour?
This was as a result of my upbringing. I saw the huge difference that living under a Labour or living under a Tory government made to me and to my mum and my sister. So that was like the burning drive. So I just threw myself into it. And I just thought, well, I love watching PMQs. I love going to debates. You know, I was a Labour Party member in every way it was possible to be. You know, I just completely threw myself into it. I was leafleting. I was door knocking. I was phone banking. I was going to meetings. You know, I just loved every part of it. And then the logical conclusion was that I worked in it. So to me, it all just felt kind of natural. It's only now when I talk to other people that they go, actually, that's a bit sad, mate. You know, a lot of people go into politics with a bit more of a plan.
Now, you put yourself on the right of the Labour Party, don't you? Which was, you know, not been a particularly fashionable place to be, it's fair to say, in the last few years. Why was that the sort of strand of Labour Party opinion that you agreed with, you identified with?
Yes, I do. And I kind of make this point in the book is for two reasons. One, I just ideologically identified more with the right of the party in that I didn't want the state to run everything. I didn't think big state socialism was the answer. I think the state has to intervene, particularly on public services. So I wasn't keen with the thought of total state control. And then secondly, and it kind of, the two are symbiotic, they kind of relate to each other, is the right of the party is more likely to win. And anything that departs from a winning course really is a betrayal of Labour values. And and then you look what Labour's done to itself in the last 10 years, the self-indulgence of it, and you just think, I'm not sure you people actually do care about people like me, because if you did, you'd have done the things that really were required to win. So that's why I was always on the right of the party for intellectual and for emotional reasons.
And can you understand, or can you identify with, I mean, I think we're all quite marked, aren't we, by, as you say, and as you detail, when we came of political age, as it were, or what that era was. And, you know, it's hard not to be marked by that for your adult life, really. But do you think if you'd been a teenager in the last 5 years or so, you know, can you imagine yourself looking at Jeremy Corbyn and thinking, God, we just need things to be different. This guy seems to have a different way of looking at things. You know, can you identify with it at all?
Yeah, very possibly. I mean, as someone who joined the SWP at 14, then I guess absolutely. But I left the SWP quite quickly. And I think I'd have gone on a similar thing had I ever been enamoured with Corbyn in the same way, is that the futility of it is deeply frustrating. And actually, I think being a prime minister is a big job, as we said, and it requires impressive people. And actually, leadership is really important. And it's important to pick people who can actually do the job. And incompetence is infuriating. And I think whilst I would have agreed with some of what Corbyn said back when I was 14, just as I was repelled by people in the SWP who behaved in a particular way, I'd have been similarly repelled by those close to Corbyn and Corbyn himself. And in the end, just the futility of pursuing an incompetent leader would have driven me mad.
Don't you think, I mean, when Labour's sort of infinite capacity to sort of conduct civil wars never ceases to surprise me, but, you know, can't both sides of the party be pretty obnoxious when they try?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, no one side has a monopoly on appalling behaviour, stitching up selections or any of the dark arts of politics, of course. But I just think the last 5 years really have been something completely different and a real departure. I mean, there are certain things that you can definitely measure. Labour was never investigated by the Equalities and Human Rights Commission under any previous leader. And I think that in itself, the fact that investigation even exists, speaks volumes. And of course, the public delivered their verdict. And you can either listen to the public or not. And if you're not listening to the public, what on earth are you doing in politics? Like, politics is about people. If you're not listening to the people, you're in the wrong job.
Yeah, although, of course, you know what they would say. They'd say we should have listened to the people about Brexit. And we should have, you know, had some sort of policy that would have meant going ahead with Brexit. And, you know, which, of course, they couldn't do because that's not what the party membership wanted them to do. And then, therefore, you had this kind of rather tortuous path to the 2019 election campaign. And, you know, that's where we ended up.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously that the landscape was so different then, was that you have a referendum which is decisively won, but close. You then have a prime minister who calls an election and loses their majority. So in a hung parliament situation, talk of a second referendum wasn't ludicrous. You couldn't get a deal through on the floor of the House of Commons. In the end, a second referendum felt like a far more sensible valve than another general election.
There's a kind of dark theme running through the book, which is about how nasty politics has become, and even to the point of violence. And you talk about your first job working with an MP, with Paddy Tipping, and you know he used to get sort of, or you talk about a sort of threatening message that he got, but it wasn't awfully serious, was it? But obviously things have taken a very, very dark turn since then.
And you're right to point that out, because it makes a very good point, which is that there has always been abuse in politics, because there's always been abuse in society, so it's nothing new. And, you know, I remember John Major getting egged in the 92 election. You know, that sort of stuff has always been there. I just think in this new era, the difference is social media has made a huge difference. But also the two things that have happened is the growth of social media and the not just the inability, but the lack of desire of many mainstream parties and movements not to challenge their own supporters. People go, well, actually, you know, we just let them get on with it for now and maybe we will deal with it later. And I just think that's created such long-term deep problems, is that mainstream parties should have the confidence to challenge their own supporters and to tell them to stop it. And that has happened very rarely, and it hasn't really happened properly. And therefore, vast armies of people online feel morally justified in using whatever means necessary to not just beat an opponent in a debate, but humiliate them and crush them and sabotage them. And that is not a positive change, and that is something that will only change when leaders of parties have the guts to take on their own side.
You don't feel that Keir Starmer's Labour Party is one that you could make your political home in again?
I don't think I'd ever join a party again. I mean, I've been to all the major parties' political conferences. I obviously have interviewed and know lots of people in every party, and have friends on every wing of every party, which is nice. But political parties basically are mad. They're all crackers. Political parties just occasionally resonate with the public a bit more than their opponents, and we then elect them in imperfect elections where we're given often poor choices. That doesn't mean that we agree with wholesale what they think. And whenever they do get elected, that's always the most acceptable face of that party at that point. Even under Blair, if you went to the Labour Party conference, it was way more left-wing than the leadership. And there was a great eccentricity about that and a great intellectual tradition that goes with it. It's not all bad, but you do realise, oh God, you know, leaders basically struggle to tame their parties. And when they do, they have a chance of winning. Keir Starmer makes it more likely that I would vote Labour, and he's the best candidate for Prime Minister. And really, Labour supporters haven't been able to truly say that for 10 years. So that's a huge, welcome, positive change. But I can't see myself kind of throwing myself back in there under any leader, really.
And you also say, you know, you also blame some of Labour members, perhaps, you know, naivety or whatever you call it, about Ed Miliband, about Jeremy Corbyn on their reading The Guardian. Is it our fault, Matt?
I should have put an asterisk. And I almost did, apart from Heather Stewart at The Guardian on that page. You know, political parties and movements, and all of us as people have to listen to hard truths. And just as us Blairites have had to listen to very difficult truths about things like Iraq and other things, the kind of soft left of the Labour Party has to confront some truths about its own purpose and behaviour. And not necessarily that it's nasty behaviour, but that certainly, I think the Miliband years were a huge wasted opportunity, and the Labour Party persevered with a leader that the country was never going to elect. The Ed Miliband years, and I know Ed, and I get on with him, and as I say in a book, you know, if you criticise Ed, it is like torturing a kitten. You know, people feel very defensive about it, and it kind of feels wrong on some levels. But that was a waste of time, and what a shame, because that government was there for the taking. We could have had a Labour government. We'd have never gone through Brexit. We'd have had a very different approach to funding our public services. And we'd have a Labour government now dealing with COVID that would be far more competent. So every party has to guard against self-indulgence. And I think that lesson is particularly pertinent for Labour in the last 10 years.
And you go further, don't you, and you know, describe the party at one stage under Jeremy Corbyn as a cesspit of racists. That's incredibly strong language, isn't it? You really think that's fair criticism?
Oh, I thought it was appalling. And, you know, I can only go on the abuse that I saw friends of mine take. Luciana Burgess is a friend of mine, and she got so much abuse she had to leave. That's incredible. It was just how obvious the abuse was and how nasty it was. Again, it comes back to that point. They did nothing to stop it. And this was apparently the most peaceful leader we'd ever had, kinder, gentler politics and stuff like that. And they unleashed hell on anyone who dared disagree with them. And that is just such a departure from the Labour Party and what it should be. it's hard to reach any other conclusion than it was a total cesspit in that period.
And stepping back from Labour and looking at the picture more broadly, you know, you talk about this idea of the collapse of the centre, don't you? That there has been a feeling, particularly since 2016, that the sort of centre in British politics kind of wouldn't hold. You know, there was this feeling that, you know, Blair was centrist. Cameron, in some ways, took on, you know, he was talked about as the heir to Blair, wasn't he? He took on some of those policies and had, in some ways, a sort of similar approach to doing politics. That's all been swept away, hasn't it? We're looking at a very different political picture now.
The reason why the centre collapsed, really, was that political parties themselves let the public down. The vast majority of British people are around the centre. Our politics has evolved along with our society to have a mixed economy, is that people value the NHS and our schools, but they don't want the state to run everything. And that's where broadly the British people are. And if you look at election results, when Labour was in that position, it was electoral dynamite, the most popular we've ever been. So it was the fact that political parties are the gatekeepers of our democracy, and both the Tory party and the Labour party stopped listening to the mainstream British opinion. And that's why you ended up with Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson as leading our two major parties, was the Tories and the Labour Party both failed to really cater for the majority of voters.
And you talk about Boris Johnson there. I suspect he probably thinks he is quite in touch with mainstream opinion. And I suspect he probably thinks he has the sort of common touch or the emotional intelligence or whatever you call it that Tony Blair had. But, you know, you're a long time watcher of his, obviously. Have you been surprised at how bad he seems to be at the job of being Prime Minister?
Well, that's it. It's different to being a kind of entertainer, which he was prior to this. You know, he was their comic relief character. And of course, people like a bit of a laugh. So I think people, despite their own politics, will occasionally find Boris Johnson entertaining or funny, even when he is Prime Minister. But that is very different to really understanding where the country is. And I think most people might periodically agree with some of what he says at any one point. But overall, my instinct is that they don't think he's up to it. They don't think he's a competent leader. They think Keir Starmer would do a better job. I don't think he has the same instinct for public opinion. And I think there is a real difference between occasionally making people laugh and really getting people's lives and where they're going. And I just don't think he does get people.
In a way, the flip side of that is, you know, during the Labour leadership campaign, lots of Labour MPs that you talk to would sort of say, oh, well, you know, I think Keir Starmer's the right candidate, but he's a little bit boring, you know, he hasn't got very much pizzazz. People were sort of complaining. But of course, that's exactly boring, sort of steady competence, to use his favourite word, is exactly what we need at the moment, right?
Absolutely. And I think with politicians, sometimes make a virtue out of it. The lesson from people like Boris and Farage isn't to be like them. It's to find the truth about yourself and sell it and make a virtue out of it. And I thought one of Gordon Brown's best ever lines, I think it's 2007 or 8 conference speech, which said, I'm a serious man and there's a lot to be serious about. And he thought, that is bang on. Keir Starmer, I think, is doing a pretty good job at that, of saying, yes, I am serious. We're going through the biggest public health crisis we've ever seen. that's a value to the country. Serious people are what we need.
Well, we appreciate you valiantly still trying to find the gags in all of it, Matt.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've succeeded there.
Even in times like these. And I hope you're not I hope you're not eternally politically homeless. I hope it's a temporary state, not a permanent one. Thanks ever so much, Matt. It's really nice to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
There will be a link to Matt's book, Politically Homeless, on today's episode description on the Guardian website. But that's all from us this week. With less than 2 weeks to go until the US presidential election, host of Politics Weekly Extra, Jonathan Friedland, gathered together some of The Guardian's best US reporters in a live event earlier in the week. Lauren Gambino, Daniel Strauss and Richard Wolff discussed the latest news from this pretty bonkers campaign. You can listen to this event in a special Politics Weekly episode that will go out tomorrow morning. Jonathan and Richard will then be back on Friday morning to bring you the must-know details from the final presidential debate. So, basically, keep an eye on the Politics Weekly feed. But for now, I want to thank our guests Peter Walker, Rajiv Sayal, Caroline Noakes and Matt Ford. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.